Hey, deserving listeners, I thought I would answer some patron emails. This first email is from highest tier patron, anonymous patron. She says, "Hi, Kirk. I have been listening to the podcast for quite a while and almost using it as homework and ways to continue finding understanding and healing from my traumas. I've been diagnosed with complex PTSD, borderline tendencies, and reactive attachment disorder due to adoption and abuse. I've experienced emotional, sexual, and physical abuse. I've been in therapy for years and have seen some of the benefits. The problem I find myself running into is fear in opening up about my current relationship in therapy. I desperately want to leave my relationship." So just chiming in here, I kind of worded that funny. What she's saying is that she wants to leave her partner, but she has a hard time opening up about it in therapy. Okay. "I desperately want to leave my partner. It's very toxic and at times very verbally abusive, but I feel unable to leave. My unhealthy attachment styles, coupled with a lifetime of traumas, have made me feel helpless. I know that therapy takes time, and I can't magically wake up tomorrow ready to leave. I'm wondering if you could just give some advice on little ways I can begin deprogramming my unhealthy attachment. Are there little things I should be doing daily? Are there ways to begin separating myself without just leaving? Thanks for all you do. It has helped me invest more into therapy and doing the work to heal." End of email. Well, anonymous highest tier patron, let me get into this. So what you're asking, well, first off, I'm so sorry that you went through what I'm imagining to be just horrific, ongoing, multi-factored abuse that you were experiencing as a child. Adoption, abuse, emotional, sexual, physical, you know, complex PTSD, borderline tendencies, reactive attachment disorder. Yeah, it's just the worst. It's totally unfair that this happened to you. I don't understand how the universe works in this way, but it does. And so I'm sorry that happened. And good for you for getting the help that you deserve, facing it, and trying to be a net good in the world. You know, working on one's traumas really can help with that, can help us to avoid getting involved in defenses that can harm other people. So, you know, you're doing way better than the vast majority of humans on the planet, you know, because it's, you're working your way uphill the entire time. So good for you. And then you're asking, you're saying that you can't leave your partner. You're also saying you're having a hard time opening up about it in therapy. The first thing I say is whenever that sort of thing happens, let me ask you a series of questions. So if I asked you, do you think you would talk about this issue with your therapist in the next session? And you'd say, no, that's too scary or something. And I say, okay, could you talk about talking about it? Could you say, well, there's something I want to say, tell you about, but I'm worried about something. Okay, could you have a conversation about having a conversation? If you say yes, then do that. If you say no, then I might say, I would ask you, can you have a conversation about having a conversation about having a conversation? Like, you're pulling yourself further and further away from the actual conversation, but you're leading up to it. So something that would be leading up to it would be to talk or to raise the topic with your therapist of like, you could sit down and say, I have some things that I may or may not want to talk about that aren't like super critical to my life. So don't get worried. It's not like, you know, anyone's going to die or anything. It's not suicide or homicide. It's not anything. But there's some things that I just have a little bit of a hard time talking about sometimes. Can we talk about that? So that's talking about, talking about, talking about. And then if you say yes to that, then do that. If you say no, then maybe there's even further back where you could say, I would like to talk about being comfortable revealing things in general. So you're not referring to anything in particular. You might even bring up something that happened in the past that you've already revealed. You could say, I want to talk about that thing that I told you 6 months ago, and how hard it was for me actually to bring that up with you, and then how good it felt to actually talk about that, or that thing that was hard for me to tell you about, and I actually have a complaint about the way that you reacted, which made it harder for me to, you know. So that's even further away from even talk, because you're not even revealing that there's even a thing to reveal, right? So that's what I would say. And then you just start there and you just start working your way toward what you want to talk about. The other thing that you're asking is how, you're saying little advice, you're saying, give me some advice on ways I can begin to deprogram my unhealthy attachment. So, you know, I don't know your relationship with your partner, but from the description, meaning that I don't know if it's empirically a bad idea or not. I'll take your word for it. It's not hard to imagine what you're talking about. You're saying it's very toxic and very and at times very verbally abusive. So, you know, it sounds believable for sure. So if we go with that, then yeah, we would say that's an unhealthy attachment. And you say, you know, what's some advice? Well, it's not a matter of deprogram. I mean, maybe you could say that, but when we lack secure attachment, safe attachments growing up, we'll take anything we can get, even though our conscious mind will say otherwise, right? Our conscious mind will say, I don't need this shit. I can live on my own. I'm fine. I have other people in my life, or I'll find someone else. But our inner world is not accessible by our conscious mind. You know, for someone like me who didn't have that background, my inner world just happens to coincide with my conscious mind, right? When I say I don't want to do this or that, generally, you know, not all the time, of course, but, you know, I'd say 75% of the time, my inner impulse, my emotions, my schemas, my actual behavior will coincide with what I want to happen and what my values are, right? If I were for example, if I was in an abusive relationship, it might take me a bit, but for me to leave, I would consciously want to leave, and then I would actually do the behaviors to leave, right? There wouldn't be a part of me sucking me back in sufficiently to stay in the relationship, right? And so there's this illusion that I might have that my conscious mind has the power to exert control over my behavior, which is, we all understand that's not true. And you're an example of that. You know, your inner world in all likelihood is saying, hey, no, I know it's bad, but being alone is worse. And it's hard to convince that inner child or that inner person that it's okay to let go. It's really hard to do that. It, you know, it could be virtually impossible at times, as you have found out, right? So, you know, some things to think about are, instead of thinking about leaving the partner, the thing you should be focusing on, this is what I focus on with clients in your situation, is finding healthier relationships. So the idea goes is that because that inner person can't let go, if they have someone else to hold on to, it'll be easier for them to let go. You know, if letting go means having no one or not having a significant attachment ready to go, then that inner child they're not going to let go. You know, think about like if you're hanging from a tree branch and someone comes up and says, jump into my arms, I'll catch you. You're like, no. But if someone comes up with a ladder and you grab the ladder, you know, it's easier to let go of the branch, right? Because you're holding on to something else. So if you have other secure relationships, and I'm not talking about just like people you can sort of confide in, I'm talking about like real deep attachments, you know, people that you talk with very frequently, interact with frequently. There's a lot of love, a lot of security, a lot of trust, a lot of loyalty and dedication. That's hard, you know? And if your abusive partner prevents you from doing that, then that's going to be hard too, right? Your therapist, though, can be that person. It's not ideal because your therapist isn't there all the time, but, you know, that's that sort of intensity has, of course, been known to happen, and it can be very beneficial to people, and it can play that role. So that's one thing to think about. The other thing is, you know, you ask, are there little things I should be doing daily? And I love this question, because this is exactly in line with what I would have told you to do anyway, which is to ask yourself and set a reminder on your smartwatch or your Google Calendar or Post-it notes or something. Ask yourself repeatedly throughout the day, maybe 10 times, 50 times, however many times you can tolerate, really. Ask yourself, what am I feeling right now? What am I feeling right now? What am I feeling right now? What do I want right now? What do I want? What do I want right now? You won't have answers necessarily to those questions because of your neglect and trauma growing up. It can be scary not to have an answer to that question. That's the abyss of lack of self that can really dysregulate people. It's terrifying. I've been with clients and friends, frankly, who have been forced to face that abyss in a particular moment. It's very unnerving. And if you have borderline tendencies, there's, you know, I don't know if you have this, but that emptiness is, you know, sometimes present, and it's a very unnerving, horrific experience. You can reassure yourself, you do have a self. There is no abyss. It's just dark. That's all it is. I use the analogy that you're looking into you're in the hallway and you're looking into your bedroom and it's pitch black. You can't see anything. That doesn't mean that there isn't a bed and a desk and a poster and whatever else, you know, clothes, closets, whatever is in your bed. There's stuff in there, but the lights are turned off. You can't see in there. So you have to do what you can. At first, maybe you walk in this, I guess I'm extending the analogy, to walk into the room occasionally and just kind of feel around for things. And although you can't see it, you just have to trust that that is in fact a thing that you can feel. Over time, as you become more in tune and connected neurologically, I think, I don't have direct science around this, but the way that the brain operates, I'm guessing that this is how it works, that as you become more practiced neurologically and consciously paying attention to something, what fires together wires together, and what happens is, you know, your neurons will start making more connections and stronger connections that are more likely to fire, that are taking notice of perceptions that you were trying to develop when you were a child, but you were prevented from doing so. You can do that, though. And as you do that, then you start to turn up that dimmer switch on the wall in the bedroom. And if you do that for long enough, you don't have to work hard at seeing what's in the room. And there is no abyss, and it's not horrifying because you can see everything. You're grounded. So by asking yourself, the road to that is, what do I want? What am I feeling? What am I feeling? What do I want? What urges do I have? What sort of motivations do I have right now from me? Not what I can tolerate, not what I'm being told to do. What do I want? What do I feel? Where am I right now? It might even start fundamentally of, okay, well, what physical sensations am I having? Because that, you know, asking yourself, what do you feel, can be hard sometimes. But if you can identify, well, my foot, like right now, I'll just say what I'm feeling physically. My feet have socks on them. And as usual, I do not have shoes on. I have sandals next to my feet because I can barely even stand wearing sandals. I don't like anything. I don't like having my body constricted. It like really drives me bonkers. But I can feel the bottoms of my feet, particularly you got the heel and the ball of your foot. Is that how they by your toes kind of? I can feel those on the carpet underneath my desk, and I'm sitting forward right now on my chair, and my butt is my buttocks are on the vinyl or fake leather, you know, seat through my jeans and my undies. My elbows are on the desk. My hands are clasped, and in front of me, also on the desk, I can feel my shoulders kind of, I don't know if tense is the right word, but they're sort of up. They're not tense. They're just sort of like, you know, I'm talking. I can feel my lips as I talk. Okay. So if you can do that, then that's great. That's a definite step in the right direction, because it might sound absurd, but the level of denial of your opportunity to know who you are and how you feel and that you exist in the world was denied you. And you got to start at the beginning, which is, I'm here on this planet, and this is physically what I'm feeling. You know, like, I'm also feeling like a slight sweat on my hands because they're clasped, you know, sort of like holding someone's hand for too long. I'm feeling very neutral about the temperature in the room right now, which is perfect for me. I guess I could feel my shirt on my body. It's a Elliott Smith shirt, custom that I made, not made, but ordered. Anyway, So if you can start there, then that's great. If you can also answer the question, how do you feel? Then that's great too. What are my motivations? So set an alarm hundreds of times a day if possible, but as many as possible. What do I feel? What do I want? And really, you know, sit there, even if there's a question mark, what do I feel? You might immediately say, I don't know what I feel. Then it's okay. But just sit there for a second. Don't run. It's okay to have a question mark. Just take a second. Sometimes if people take just even a couple seconds, they might actually start to realize what they feel. It's okay at the end of those 10 seconds of thinking and say, yeah, I don't know what I feel. That's okay. Just know that if you keep asking, eventually, in all likelihood, you will start to see what is in that bedroom, because you're turning up the dimmer. By asking that question, you're slowly turning up that dimmer switch. And what do I want? What are my needs right now? You know, am I hungry? Do I want a hug? Do I want to get out of this place? Do I need to go to the bathroom? I mean, literally, you know, like Umberto actually runs into this. I often marvel, because, you know, we'll be recording these long stretches of audio or whatever, video, audio, podcasts together. And I often am, you know, going to the bathroom, partially because I just hate having the urge during a recording. So I'll like preemptively go. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm just, even if I don't necessarily have to, it's sort of like your parents before a long road trip would say, you know, look, go to the bathroom, even if you don't have to go terribly, go, because, you know, it'll make it, you'll last longer in the car. It's sort of like that. Well, Berto almost never goes to the, he'll come over to my house, we'll record literally for 8 hours straight, and he doesn't even stand up from his chair. He just sits there. I'm always squirming. I'm standing up. I'm sometimes in the middle of a podcast, I sort of give Berto this hand signal that says, like, keep going. I'm not standing up because there's something wrong with the podcast. I'm standing up because I'm not talking right now and I need to kind of stretch, which will be optimal. So I'll give him my hand signal. I'll stand up. I stretch. I sit back down. Berto never moves. And I'm always thinking, I'm a very fidgety person. My God, I must just be like this nervous bundle all the time, which I think is partially true. But it's also true that because of Berto's traumas that he had to work on in therapy a lot, but he still needs work on it, is he ignores his body. Or if he notices something, he will downplay it for the greater, what he believes to be the greater good. It's not the greater good to me. You know, there's this thing inside of him that's, I think, that is saying, look, this is going to inconvenience other people, so ignore it. You're stronger than that. You can push past it or something. And very recently, because I've been kind of trying to push him on this, because I'll see evidence of stuff like this, that he's told me, I think the last time I recorded, he said, look, Kirk, can you just tell me to go to the bathroom? Because he went to the bathroom at the end of recording for a really long time last time we were recording. And he came back out of the bathroom and he said, I just took one of the longest pees of my entire life. Kurt, can you tell me to actually go? Which is weird because when we break, I'm often going to the bathroom. It's a perfect time for him to go. You know what I mean? So, you know, swords, that kind of thing. And so, but that's, it's an interim phase. Of course, the goal we want to achieve is that he can notice his body and value it and also not be so concerned about inconveniencing other people, right? But in the interim, he's asking for my help, which is great. You know, I absolutely can. And this can sort of facilitate those phases of growth and development. You know, I'll be that superego for him. I'll say, hey, go to the bathroom. Or, you know, remember that time where you ignored that? And that, and then so I can do that. Eventually, he'll be more in tune. You know, the idea is that he'll be more in tune with that as time goes forward. So, you know, you're asking a little thing you can do daily. Just keep asking, what do I want? How do I feel? Do it right now. Take the opportunity. Pause the podcast. Everyone, literally, this is good for everybody, honestly. Especially in today's world where you just have constant update, you know, like notifications on your phone and the increase of capitalists being able to make us work literally 24/7, and the constant pressures on our life and the keeping up with the Joneses, like we're moving further and further away from what do I want and what do I feel? So the idea is that when you can answer those questions, kind of, then you will be able to evaluate when and how and if to leave your partner. That's the whole thing. Because you're, in all likelihood, there's a possibility, I don't know, but there's a possibility that what's happening for you, anonymous, highest tier patron, is that you are noticing there's something wrong in this relationship. It's very abusive, and I know better. I've learned that I shouldn't be here. So why am I not leaving? There's a good possibility that the reason why you're not leaving is because you're not in connection with your needs and specifically your anger. For me, when I am abused, and I've been abused in a variety of contexts, including romantic relationships, and because I was raised well enough, I feel anger. I feel anger because there's an injustice. I'm being mistreated. And I will say, fuck this shit. I deserve better. I don't know if everyone would call that anger. We can call it a lot of different things. But in the broad sense, it's an emotion of anger. You know, injustice produces an emotion of anger, and then we will act on it. There's a feeling, there's an action, there's a urge, there's a behavior, motivation. So there's a chance that, yeah, intellectually you're thinking, this doesn't make a lot of sense. I should not be here. But that anger is being suppressed, denied, ignored. It may be it's inaccessible. You're not actively pushing it down necessarily, right? It's just like hard to access. If you can feel it, and this applies to everyone listening, there are so many people that, Berto included, right? Like part of the motivation to say, I need to go to the bathroom, you know, you could say it's anger is very motivating, is my point. There's a lot of motivation power in getting angry, right? My bladder hurts. This pisses me off. I'm going to the goddamn bathroom, you know? I don't know if we want to call it anger. Call it like just asserting yourself or taking care of yourself, whatever. But whatever that is, and getting in contact with that requires being in contact with emotion. Because when you are being abused and you're being contained and limited, right, and harmed, there's an inside need that is being neglected by the world, and you're feeling that tension inside of you, and you're getting angry. You're saying, there's a part of you that's like, I don't want this. Now, the inner part of you might not know exactly what to do with it, because it's primordial, right? It's up to our executive function to figure out, well, what does that mean exactly, right? but that inner primordial feeling is definitely there. I've never felt it. Why would it be there if I've never felt it? Unless you're an alien from outer space, if you're being abused, you're angry, because of course you are. And of course you had to deny that and suppress it when you were very young because you had to survive, right? I'm making a lot of assumptions, so, you know, take all this with a grain of salt. But getting in touch with what do I want? What do I feel? Because if the more you're in connection with that as you're being abused or after, you will ask again this repetitive question, what do I feel? I feel unsafe. I feel hurt. You know, these are all kind of question marks. And that's another thing to do, is to sort of try on things, right? If you ask this question, you say, what do I feel? And then there's this blank. You don't know how you feel. Give it some time. Like I said, don't just take that as evidence that nothing is accessible. It might take 5 seconds. The next thing you can do actually is to just say, well, what would other people feel here? Or what might I be feeling deep down? And you think, well, I might be feeling hurt, and I might be feeling angry. I might be feeling afraid. Am I feeling afraid? What would it feel like to be afraid? What would it feel like to be hurt? What would it feel like to be angry? Those are other questions that you can fill in there if there's nothing readily acceptable. Accessible, not acceptable. Then you can ask, what do I want? What do I want? And again, give it some time, because maybe something will come. And then you can think, well, what would someone else want if they did feel hurt and afraid and angry? What would they want? I guess they would maybe want to get out, or to defend themselves, or to leave physically or something. And you don't have, and the thing is you don't have to do it. That's the fear that can keep a lot of people from accessing these feelings, because they'll feel like, well, if I start to entertain this area and say, well, I feel this way and thus I want this, oh, God damn it, I have to do it. That's too scary. No. Feelings and wants and urges and motivations are just that. They have nothing to do with actually taking action. There are so many feelings and motivations and urges that I have that I never take action on, because I conclude it's not the right time, or it's not appropriate, or it's not moral, or it's not in my values, or it's not the, you know, it's not going to fit in with my situation. But at the very least, just recognize that you don't have to take action. You could for a couple years, you could just sit with acknowledging what you feel and what you want, and never leave your partner. Those are completely separate things. They're related, of course. Actual action is related. That's the whole point. But it's not required, and there's no rush. And that voice that says, well, if we start to feel, and we start to need, and we start to want, then all shit's going to hit the fan, and everything's going to fall apart, and the kids, what about the kid, or whatever, right? That voice is the abuser in your head, probably from your childhood, saying, if you feel and pay attention to yourself, very, very bad things will happen. Parents sometimes, you know, abusive people will literally say this to children in not so many words. Let's say, like, if you have emotions, or, you know, I don't know, like, I'm trying to think of an exact scenario. Anyway, I can't think of one, but just, you know, you might be able to think of some for yourself, of these messages being given to children that are very explicit, that the child cannot pay attention to themselves and have emotion, or else very, very bad things will happen to them. And so, I mean, at the very least, when you're a child and you're stuck in that situation and you have an urge, because the mechanism of suppression and denial hasn't been fully realized yet, you know, might be 3 years old, and you are starting to learn neurologically and consciously that even if you allow yourself to think about yourself, there's a good chance that that will lead to you maybe even just crying can get you more abuse, right? So it's better to deny, right? So it was true in the past that to pay attention to oneself actually did lead often to abuse and lack of safety. But that's no longer the case in all likelihood. I don't know, but in all, the way you describe it, I mean, the fact that you're in therapy says you're not completely isolated and gaslit and everything. So, yeah. And then you ask, are there any ways to begin separating myself without just leaving? This is when you could say this whole thing that I'm saying is in line with that, that you are, this is for you. And it is not for your partner to think about what do I want and what do I feel, particularly if they are things that are counter to what your partner wants, right? But they're just internal and you don't have to share or do anything about it, but it's your world and it's you and you get to have that. And it is by nature separate from your partner. It's the same for everyone. My inner world is separate from Stacy. I have an inner world that is not connected to her. I get to have that. She gets to have hers as well. And you get to have yours. Without that, it's very difficult to do anything. And even if you did manage to somehow get away, if you still weren't in connection with that, it's really hard not to go back, honestly. So that will help. Now, there's a whole practical side to this that, of course, talking with your therapist, finding a DV specialist, an advocate, you can contact these organizations by calling the National DV Hotline, right? And getting in contact with, sometimes it's a therapist, sometimes it's a volunteer that will be very practical with you. They won't pressure you to leave. I mean, all the ones that I've worked with, and I'm pretty sure it's a part of the whole program that, you know, there's a set of principles. And of course, they know better because they're often recovered victims themselves, that to pressure someone to leave is wrong and immoral in a lot of ways, but also it pushes people away, pushes victims away because to shame them or to push them can be scary. So these advocates and these helpful professionals will never do that. They'll never pressure you, but they will at least give you a path if you want to take, even if it's just temporary. You know, leaving isn't necessarily leaving for good. Of course, that sounds like that's what you want. But in the interim, you can leave in a variety of ways. You can leave for a night or for an hour or for... You're just even not in the middle of a fight. You could be like, I'm going to take a vacation. I'm going to take a road trip by myself. There's a lot of different things one can do without having to commit to just leaving, right? So, I mean, the fact that you're in therapy, the fact that you're emailing me is leaving in a sense, or at least it's separate, right? The fact that you have a thought of, I want to leave, is separate. So, that's another thing that you could do maybe is just to, in your mind or in a journal or something, you can write out everything that is you, just even qualities that you have, that's you and not a part of your partner. There's just separate things about you that, you know, not even just like I like cats and my partner doesn't, you know, that kind of stuff. So hope that helps. Let me know. Everyone, let's take a break. All right, we're back from the break. So middle tier patron Alexandra, she wrote in and sent me a link to Reddit and says, hi, Kirk, I found this funny post on the R Therapist subreddit and I thought, what would Dr. Kirk say? Okay, so let's open this up. All right, this was posted last year on the therapist subreddit. And it says therapist house party. This is a fun post. Let's say there's a house party. Each therapist based profession is invited. MFT, LPC, LCSW, psychiatrist, psychologist, etc. It's funny that they put an etc. I'm pretty sure the only person we're leaving out here is a psychiatric nurse, honestly. You know, because you got marriage, family therapists, you have counselors, social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists. You just need psychiatric nurse there. Pretty sure that's everybody. So let's say there's a house party and each profession is invited. What do each bring to the party? What do they talk about? Who do they hang out with? What do they do at the party? I'll go first as a marriage and family therapist. I'd bring a charcuterie board, ask about your significant other constantly and want to play subjective guess who. Subjective guess who? What's that? Subjective guess who? Let's Google subjective guess who. Subjective guess who? Oh, it's a nostalgic board game that went viral. Oh, okay. So it's like a, looks like a simple kind of, looks simple. Hopefully, I don't know. Anyway, looks kind of fun. Okay. Well, first off, I'm glad you sent me this. I Reddit threads are kind of fun to talk about in the podcast and look at. I'm not a huge fan of these kinds of threads on Reddit because often I don't know. Of course, everyone's just joking, but it just seems to reduce an entire mammoth group of people to like stereotypes or something, which I'm not a huge fan of. But if we're just saying, let's just make fun of us for a second, then yeah, I'm all for that. So someone named Fulf, who is a psychotherapist in the UK, says, I'm a person-centered therapist who works a lot of trauma, That's kind of a weird way of... I thank the host kindly for their invite and stay home to be away from socializing. Ha ha ha. Okay. And then someone replies to that and say, ha ha ha, same. I'm a huge introvert and an LPC, licensed professional counselor, and I specialize in trauma. I would thank the host for the invite, kindly decline and stay home playing Baldur's Gate 3. I love that game. Yeah. I feel like I should do a deep dive on introversion, extroversion, because there's a lot of seeming misunderstanding about that. Because going to a party or not going to a party isn't necessarily an extrovert-introvert difference. There's just different sort of people, really. Like, you can be an extrovert and actually be the sort of person that wouldn't want to go to parties, which might sound weird, but that is... It's absolutely possible. And it's absolutely possible to be an introvert and totally enjoy parties. The construct isn't... we tend to use it as a stand-in for people that are more social versus asocial, right? Which people tend to use the word antisocial, but what they really mean in that context is asocial, meaning without social. And so... anti is against. And so if you're against society, then you're harmful, right? But if you're just without society, then that's asocial. Anyway, I think I have my Latin. Is it Latin or Greek? Anyway, one of those. The next person that commented, psychotherapy memes is their actual handle, and they're a licensed marriage and family therapist, and they identify as a psychodynamic therapist, and they say, I'm a psychodynamic therapist, and I'm bringing your mom. That's actually funny. I'm a psychodynamic therapist, and I'm just bringing your mom to the party. It also just sounds kind of like you're starting a fight, like your mama joke or something. Next person, a social worker, school-based, elementary, named K. Bearclaw. They say, I bring a bunch of Cheez-Its, popcorn, pretzels. Ooh, I love Cheez-Its. I love popcorn. Depends on pretzels. Kind of depends. Finger food stuff. So I bring those things. I keep trying to get people to play Candyland with my own twist on the rules. Someone pulls out Monopoly and I cry. I don't get it. So I bring food, finger food stuff. So I'm a child. Oh, because in elementary school, there's always snacks. I'm guessing. Is that what they're getting at? I keep trying to get people to play Candyland, because that's probably what she does all day, with my own twist on the rules. I don't know if that's because she deals with a lot of kids that have different rules for Candyland, or she just has a different twist on the rules to kind of facilitate therapy. Literally the last time I played Candyland was with a kid in therapy. I worked with pre-12 kids, kids younger than 12 for the first, I don't know, four years of my career. And they were only a small percentage of my clients, but that's the last time I played Candyland. I played it as a kid and loved, wait, no, Candyland. I'm thinking Chutes and Ladders. Candyland. What's Candyland? Candyland. I just have to look at the board. I'm going to Candyland game. Okay. Googling it. Candyland. Yeah, it looks very much like Chutes and Ladders. So it looks like it's, I think you're just trying to get to the end, right? Yeah. So anyway, and then they say, okay, I pull out a game Candyland. Okay. Someone pulls out Monopoly and I cry. I don't understand that. Is this therapist acting like a child, like one of the clients? Or is it because it's too complicated for child therapists? Someone loves it. Says, oh my God, love this. I'm also a social worker in oncology, and I'm going to bring a MYO salad. MYO salad? There's so many terms. What's MYO salad? It's a type of salad, apparently. It's just like beans and stuff. Because it's a healthy option, and I hope that there's something here for everyone. I'm going to try to make small talk by asking you probing medical questions that are not my business, okay, because that's what you're doing at your job. Then later, when I'm stuck with the one person who wants to overshare, at the party, I'll stare longingly and wish I was the art therapist getting high and chasing butterflies. That's kind of funny. But so, you know, that I guess that's another thing I think about these kinds of Reddit threads is that if you just describe your job, right? If you're just like, I come to the party and I, you know, it's like if I were to do this sort of version of the joke, I would say, well, I'm trained as a psychologist and I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist as well. I'm also a supervisor, and I won't try to be funny because I'm trying to make a point. And so what I do is for half the time, I assess everyone's personality. And then the other half of the time, I'm assessing the hierarchies of the people in the party or something. You know what I mean? It's like if I just recreate my job, that's not, I guess it's kind of funny, but it's not as funny as psychotherapy memes who says, I'm a psychodynamic therapist and I'm bringing your mom. I mean, that's, you know, that's taking it this whole, you get it? Anyway, I'll stop reading this. Let's go into another email. But thanks, Alexander. That was fun. Actually, first, let's do an OPP. These are annual patrons who have been patrons ever since 2021, which is coming up on 3 years. So we have Sophia from Germany. We got Robin from Lansing, Michigan. We have S. Korb from Tucson, Arizona. We got Timothy, who looks like they're a social worker, from Greendale, Indiana. Sounds nice there, I think. Katie from Oregon. Alora from Portland, Oregon. Destiny from Iowa City. And Holly from good old Seattle. And also, the following people are from God knows where. We have Jody, Parissa, Kaylin, and Allie. Thank you so much for becoming a patron and staying a patron through thick and thin for 3 years. That is truly just the most flattering, and I'm so honored. Seriously. All right, this next email is from middle tier patron Mary from Seattle. She says, hi, Dr. Honda. I was listening to you while falling asleep yesterday, and I ended up having a fun dream about you leading a group to an adventure trip. Just chiming in here. I always love hearing about people's dreams about the podcast. I have, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I watch a lot of YouTube channels, and I have dreams about them too. On one hand, it feels like, well, wait, what? I don't even know these people. Like, is this what a harmful parasocial relationship is like? And then, but it's, you know, it's a course, because especially if you're listening to me as you're falling asleep, I mean, that's just a sure way to have a dream about me. So then you go on. There was a beautiful lake. So I'm leading a group on an adventure trip. Okay. There was a beautiful lake where a local was riding a horse on the lake instead of a sea scooter. A sea scooter. What's a sea scooter? I have to Google so many things today. Sea scooter. I don't see anything that looks like us. I see all these underwater things. Anyway, there was some performance in French of Anne Hathaway where I complimented her on her accent. Yeah, this sounds definitely like a dream with all these random things. The dream ended with you saying we needed to retreat for safety reasons as we were climbing a mountain with Stacy, and it was about to rain. And I was thinking how responsible this was. Ha ha. Anyway, I'll take this opportunity to share. Oh, so that's the end of your dream. Yeah. Huh. So you could analyze that pretty readily, right? There's all sorts of, I don't know what those symbols mean to you. You know, what me, Stacy, mountain, safety, rain, Anne Hathaway, sea scooters. Yeah, it's pretty rich ground to work with. Going on with your email. Anyway, I'll take this opportunity to share a quick reaction to the video I was watching because I could relate a lot to it. You said, quote, someone being an emotionally abusive partner doesn't mean they're a terrible person. It often stems from their own trauma. And at the same time, it doesn't mean it's okay for them to be abusive. End of quote. Yeah. Going on with you, this deeply resonated with me and my situation and as to why I stayed so long in an abusive relationship. I also still feel guilt from leaving without breaking up and helpless from still hoping to go back to him even after 2 years of silence. End of email. Yeah, well, this email is apropos of the first email. And yeah, it's just awful that abuse victims will internalize the abuser and continue to abuse themselves even though they're out of the abuse. And, you know, you recognize this, I hope, as not rational, but it's an inner voice internalized, and it's not a voice you want to regard, but it's there, and, you know, it's there. Can't get rid of it necessarily very quickly. And the voice is saying to you that you should feel guilty for not having left earlier. You know, you say, I still feel guilt from leaving without breaking up. Oh, so you left without breaking up. Again, you know, if you're being abused, people don't just up and leave a relationship. Well, I shouldn't say that because some people do. But my point is that in all likelihood, you made the right call of like, okay, on one hand, I'm being abused. On the other hand, my ex-partner is not an evil person. They're a good person. They have a lot of trauma, but they were abusing me, and that's not okay. And I feel bad for my partner, my ex-partner, but I'm not the problem. I didn't create their problems. I didn't abuse them. I didn't traumatize them. And yet I'm incurring all the harm from that trauma, right? It's coming to me. And so I have to leave. And if I have to leave in a way that actually keeps me safe and sane, then that's just what's going to happen. And it's not the best situation, but I'm in a fucked up situation, and fucked up situations require fucked up measures to get out of fucked up situations. You know, just leaving without breaking up, if you just said that, you're like, what? But in context, like, oh, okay, well, yeah, I mean, it's the lesser of several evils, right? So I'm guessing that's what you did. So, you know, don't listen to that voice. And then you feel, you know, helpless for still hoping to go back with him, which is very common. You know, one way to think about it is that, this is the way I think about it, is that, again, neurologically, when we bond with someone, for better or for worse, whether it's a healthy relationship or an unhealthy relationship, we bond with that person. They become locked into our brain as someone that is our, you know, our attachment. I don't know what to say. It's like a familiar thing, right? It's sort of like for me, if I think of non-relationship things that I'm attached to or have this kind of vibe with me, is trees in the Pacific Northwest. I grew up in a house that was surrounded by, we were on a pretty small lot, but the lots around that we didn't own the land that was around our house, but that land was left to be forest and trees and bushes and trails that we would make. And so I spent all, you know, since there's no Atari or Nintendo or internet or anything, me and my friends, we just would disappear into the woods all day. and I would even walk to school through trails in the woods, partially. You know, it was a functional part of my life, is, you know, the smell of wet earth in the winter and the spring, the pine needles, the alder trees, the maple leaves, the salal, just all that. And when I smell that, when I'm with it, when I can see it, it really has this deep resonance with me that I will miss if I don't have an opportunity to be around it. Almost every house that I have moved into in Seattle, I put a big premium on having at least some of that in my yard or near my yard. And I currently have a house that has a lot of that, actually. I sort of lucked out with this kind of weird lot in Seattle that probably shouldn't really have a house on it and didn't until recently. But it's on a hill, and it's a very inconvenient lot to have a house on because it's hard to access from the main street, and was left for a long time because people are like, you can't build a house and that's too uneven. There's too much, you know. And so the house that I have is like that. And by consequence of that, it's sort of like nestled into the woods because anyway, point is that I lucked out and I'm attached to that. So the same goes with things that you're not fond of, like your partner, right? You spend a lot of time with the person. You smell them. You watch them move. You also have good times with them, especially in the beginning of a relationship, right? You have a lot of physical bonding, potentially, right? And you hear, you know, hearing their voice and sleeping next to them, hearing them snore, you know, whatever. There's just a lot of perceptions day in and day out that just get encoded in our brains as like, that is our person. And it, you know, once that person is gone, there's a natural tendency to want to replace, to want to get back to that. And other people won't have those same associations, right? Because they're not the same person. So it takes a while, if not forever, you know, it can take a lifetime, much longer. It's not uncommon for someone in your position to 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, still have dreams about that person, still have a part of you that wants to go back to that person. You know, you might even call your future partner his name in the future, even though it was 30 years in the past. And that's not evidence that you're in love with the person or you should be with the person or you're twin flames or whatever. It's just those neurons that got locked in, and those neurons are very important. We have a lot of our nervous system that is oriented towards building attachments and safety in relationships, especially couple relationships, right? I mean, it's what makes the world go round. All, you know, most of art is about this. It's about love and sex and bonding and family, you know. And so there's a lot of you that kind of got wired towards that person. It doesn't mean that you can't fall in love with someone else or be bonded to someone else. Of course, it doesn't mean that, but it just means, you know, there's always going to be a couple neurons at least that are going to be oriented towards that person. And by a couple neurons, I mean a lot more than a couple because we have a lot of neurons available to us. But so there's that. But yeah, absolutely. It's something that I didn't realize I would have to say what you're pointing out. I kind of rather recently, maybe in the last few years, I finally realized that I would have to say this because to me it's so obvious, but apparently it really is not. And I'm not saying that people are stupid. I'm just saying that particularly if you're in an abusive relationship. So, you know, the point that I will frequently feel like I have to say is that yes, abusive people. So, you know, the typical way that people talk about abusive people is that they're evil, right? They don't say the word evil necessarily, but you know, people say, oh, they're a narcissist. And I think what they're saying philosophically is that person is evil. They're born evil or they just are. They cannot be redeemed. They are a different sort of human. There's no hope for them. And the closer you get to them, you will automatically be harmed. And they consciously and volitionally want to harm other people. If they're being nice to you, they're just tricking you until they can be nice to you. That's what they're saying when they're saying a narcissist or a toxic person or an abusive person. I think it's somewhere on that spectrum. And certainly there are people like that. There are sadistic psychopaths. You know, Ted Bundy was a real human being. So those are, you know, they're out there, but they're extremely rare. And the possibility that someone on the internet who claims that their ex was a malignant, narcissistic, whatever, sociopath, chances are that individual is not a malignant, narcissistic sociopath. That person just, that couple went through a very common scenario where they fell in love and then they started to trigger each other's issues and then they started to fight and hurt each other's feelings. And then you left the relationship and you have a very negative point of view about that partner. That's all normal. And then you're searching online for a label to somehow validate or explain or something. And the internet is more than ready to fill people's minds with false notions of labels like that. So anyway, that's the way I think people see those kind of individuals. The way that I see the vast majority of abusive people is that they're good people, just like everyone else. They went through tremendous trauma and modeling growing up that resulted in them having adapted to a defense that results in them being flat out abusive and mean and harmful when they feel like they are, there's a lot of, you know, triggers, but a major trigger for them is when they feel like they're going to lose their partner. If their partner looks at someone else, right? They get jealous and then they react with physical violence or verbal abuse or something. If their partner seems a little standoffish, they get worried and they resort to harm and insults and maybe physical abuse, right? So when I explain it that way, it you know, evokes empathy or care or compassion for these individuals, which I think is the appropriate response. And then usually that's where I just leave it. But apparently what I need to be saying in addition to that is, but by no means does that mean you need to stay in the relationship. No, just because you have, and I think that's the function of evilizing these people is because it justifies leaving them, right? And drawing boundaries. Somehow people need to say, well, that person's evil, therefore I deserve boundaries. Even if our abusive partners are good people on the inside and their behavior isn't even necessarily their, you know, it's hard to say, of course their behavior is their fault, but it's not their fault that they were traumatized. It's not their fault that they had a violent father who taught them these kind of behaviors. It's not their fault that they're continually preoccupied with attachment loss and paranoid about losing their partners. That's not their fault. They're responsible for their behavior. They're responsible for the fact they haven't gone to enough therapy or any therapy. But, you know, we wouldn't say that, you know, like the fact that I'm not abusive is not some sort of evidence that I have this tremendous willpower. I just don't have that urge because that wasn't modeled to me and I don't have those traumas. So for individuals that do this sort of thing, you know, they're a product of their environment and they're responsible for their behavior. It's both. I hope you get my point. So, yeah, but you can still allow yourself to have boundaries with people like that just because you have compassion and you can understand how they became who they are doesn't mean that you no longer get to have boundaries. Just because someone is likable doesn't mean that you have to deal with their shit. And what I always say is I have been living this perspective for decades now. And when I come across abusive people clinically and in my personal life, I either quickly or eventually realize and can see the 10,000 foot view of this individual's life and how they got to where they are. You know, this person might be abusing me and harming me. And I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure, or I literally know the likely factors that led to that, that were not their fault, you know, abuse and neglect and harm and modeling. And yet, I am very quick to draw boundaries. In fact, when I can identify that whole ball of wax, it accelerates my drawing boundaries with these people, sometimes just completely getting as far away from them as possible, emotionally and physically. Because when I can understand the whole picture, then it makes sense to me. If I had someone that was being abusive to me and I couldn't see it for the way that I look at it, I might start wondering, well, am I making this up? Because if I can't conceptualize this whole thing, then maybe I'm just swimming in my own reactivity right now, you know? So my point is that, you know, that's what, Mary, you're saying that I was saying, that you're saying that you were thinking about, which motivated you to have a dream about something called a sea scooter. And Stacy and I were leading you up a mountain while it was raining, but then I said that it was unsafe. Let's go to another email. But let's take a break first. All right, this next email is from middle-tier patron and YouTube member, Mary from Arizona. They say, I've listened to several of your deep dives on various personality disorders, and I've found myself resonating in a big way with several of them. So how many personality disorders can a person have? None of them resonate for me in all aspects of my life 100% of the time, but in certain specific contexts, it feels like they're highly descriptive of me. End of email. Yeah, well, another way to think about it is that we all have aspects of all the personality disorders. You know, we all, for example, can feel like we're operating from a borderline personality place sometimes, right? When we're pursuing and worried that we're going to lose someone, or we're triggered by something that makes us worry that we're going to be abandoned. All of us have had that feeling, but not all of us have had the traumas. Another way of putting it is all of us have been traumatized, at least to a small extent, in the way that people with personality disorders were traumatized. You know, people with borderline were traumatized. You know, the vast majority, if not all of them, were traumatized by abandonment, whether it was by obvious abandonment, like a parent literally abandons the child, or a parent is being abusive to the child and abandons them metaphorically. So we've all had that experience of being abandoned, even by the best parents in the world, right? It's just kids misinterpreting things, or they were abandoned by other kids at school or something. And so we all have those injuries and will react. So I think when I'm describing personality disorders, and you're like, oh, you know, I think there's situations where I'm like that. In fact, I would think it would be weird if you didn't have that with all the personality disorders I describe, especially if you're especially aware of yourself, because when you're aware of yourself, then you're like, oh, you know, I do remember feeling that way. Anyway, another way of looking at it is that, yeah, when you are traumatized greatly, then there's a possibility of developing a number of schemas that result in being on the spectrum of a number of personality disorders, if not several of them. All right, so this next email is from anonymous middle-tier patron. She says, do you have any general advice or guidance for the healing process in the context of a sibling relationship where there has been parentification? I noticed that there is a particular pain that comes with conflict in this type of relationship because you have one party that has sacrificed all of their needs for the other. End of email. Okay, so it's a pretty broad question. And if I were to summarize your question, you're saying that you, it sounds like you're not saying you, but sounds like you were in a family in which there was a parentified child. You were either the parentified child or one of the other kids. And now that you're adults, you want to reconcile or improve the relationship you have with one of your siblings. And it's hard. And there's, you say, a particular kind of pain because one person had to sacrifice so much for the other. You know, the parentified child often has to sacrifice a lot for the other kids. That doesn't mean the other kids also don't sacrifice, but it sometimes can mean that. Meaning that, well, so let's just kind of tell one fictional scenario. You have a family, and there's a, let's say there's three kids in the family, and the oldest kid, they have to sacrifice a lot, and they become parentified. One thing that they have to do is they have to take care of the younger siblings because the parents are compromised somehow, either emotionally or physically or psychiatrically or substance-wise or something. And the oldest child, they have to grow up fast. At the age of 11, they're totally responsible for the younger kids. The child also has been confided in a lot by the parents. One or both of the parents will go to that 11-year-old child and dump all of their issues onto that child, and the child has to listen and help and absorb all that anxiety at the age of 11 or even younger. So that person has to sacrifice everything. They have to suppress their own needs. They have to forego their own needs. They have to blunt their reactivity sometimes. They have to be very focused on what's going on around them so that they can monitor things and react to establish safety and also getting attention. You know, that's another aspect of parentification is that kids are always looking for attention and love, right? Everyone is, but kids in particular from their caregivers. And if their caregivers are giving them love and attention, at least for a time, if not primarily, when the child is sacrificing themselves and parentifying, then the child leans into it as well because it's the one area where they get love and attention. So it's both imposed on them, but then eventually the parentified child actually will initiate it. And the parentified child will often push back on efforts to change it. You know, take it from me as a therapist that would try to change that in systems. I would not only get pushback from the parents because they're using the child in this way, but the child would also push back and say, they you know, because this is the only thing they know. It's the only world they know. And they often they lose something. You know, when I would get to that precipice, I'd work really hard. It's really hard to do. And of course, the clients have to work harder than me, but it's very hard to convince and also get some traction in families where enmeshment is happening. But anyway, let's say I get everybody on board and everyone is actually changing the routines. We'll run into this place eventually where the parentified kid, even though they're appreciating everything, they're like, finally, I can breathe. They get to this point where they still have this longing to know what their, you know, because often if their parent is confiding in them, they just want to know, and they feel cut off from that. And it's painful. It feels like an abandonment. It feels like it's a loss. At the very least, it's a change in the relationship, and that can be hard for people. And they will react either dysfunctionally or just tell me that they are having a reaction. You know, it's hard. Anyway, so let's say in this fictional story, there's a lot of pain, and the parentified kid sacrifices themselves so that the younger kids can actually develop at least a little bit more normally, but not optimally, right? Because, you know, it's not like the younger kids have a cakewalk because they're not being paid attention to anyway. You know, all the kids are, so that's one thing I'll say, anonymous middle tier patron, is that yeah, the parentified kid did sacrifice a lot, but everyone sacrificed. The other kids, because the parentified child is taking care of the younger children, but it's not a direct substitute. It's not an equal substitute for good attuned parenting from actual caregivers. You're an approximation of that as a parentified child, but you, by the nature of the fact that you're 11 years old, you can't give the child what they need. And so the kids are being deprived as well, but they're deprived less because you're tasked with giving to them and paying attention to them and helping them stay safe and all that kind of stuff, feeding them maybe. But those children also suffered. Also, there can be some weird dynamics that can happen between parentified children and the other children where a codependency relationship starts to develop where the parentified child, the codependent individual, starts to come down hard on the younger kids because the 11-year-old, the 12-year-old, the 13-year-old doesn't have the emotional maturity to be able to handle the anxiety or the pressures or the annoyances with parenting. And so sometimes they can come down too harshly. And sometimes that can result in the younger kids actually incurring more problem, more harm than the parentified kid, because the parentified kid, although is being harmed, they're not being abused because they're just being ignored or something, you know. Anyway, so that's one thing. But you're asking, you know, what's some general guidance on how to heal the relationship? Well, it's too hard to answer specifically, but generally speaking, so the tasks are that the parentified individual often will retain a lot of the codependent assumptions and impulses. And there are different styles. You know, in my deep dive, I went over the three that I came up with. You have the controlling codependent, the accommodating codependent, and then the chameleon codependent, which is rare. But, you know, the accommodating one is the one that dotes on the other person, and then the controlling is the one that controls by making the other people feel incompetent to make sure that the other people don't do things that require the codependent person, the overfunctioner, to fix their problems. So they often will keep the underfunctioner underfunctioning and isolated so that they don't take risks and they don't learn from their mistakes. So, and they don't grow. The accommodating one will do the same, but by enabling and accommodating and being quote unquote nice all the time. I say quote unquote nice because it's not nice to deprive an individual of the opportunity to make mistakes and learn within reason. Anyway, so the codependent, the overfunctioner, the parentified child, they have to really do a lot of work in therapy, either, you know, individual therapy or family therapy or something, to figure out how their reactivity operates. Because when I talk to overfunctioners, codependent people, parentified people, and I tell them, you know, so there's different phases, I'll say. In the first phase, the codependent parentified person has no idea that they're codependent, that they're parentified. And they're just operating from all those places and they're suffering. Then we get to the middle phase is they've emerged into awareness, either on their own or in therapy, and they can see it, but they have no ability to exert a control over it or to change it because it's overwhelming. And there's a sizable percentage of their personality that still believes all the hype. You know, consciously, they might be able to say, yeah, okay, I get it. I'm not responsible for my younger sister's life. Yeah, that makes sense. But then when they actually are operating in the world, or maybe even in session, they might say like, but if I don't do anything about this, then she's going to ruin her life. She's always ruining her life. Okay. So that's one phase. The next phase would be, if I just think, you know, broadly, would be that they would actually be able to exert change and they're mostly on board. they don't have a hold out part of their personality that is still holding on to the assumptions of anxiety and codependency. Because a lot of codependency and overfunctioning is based on anxiety. There's this fear that is injected into the parentified child from the parents that if you don't save your younger siblings from harm, it's on you. And not only on you, but I will reject you and abandon you if you screw this up. The whole world will fall apart if you aren't hypervigilant about making sure that your underlings are safe and taken care of. And so as a child, this is overwhelming, but a lot's at stake. Plus, the younger kids don't necessarily respect the authority of the parentified person. And sometimes the parents will undermine the parentified person. You know what I mean? So the codependent person, even if they're controlling, they're operating from fear. They're terrified. But it's all based on a lie, especially now that they're adults. They're no longer responsible for their siblings or anyone else, for that matter, that they can love. If they have kids, they're responsible for them, but they're not responsible for their spouse or their employees or anything like that in the way that they feel they are emotionally. So the codependent person, their task is emerging through that, and it's hard. And if you're trying to resolve conflicts between siblings, in all likelihood, everything depends on that. Because if the codependent person keeps engaging in codependency with the sibling, that's going to be hard. It's going to produce conflict and hurt feelings. The other kids, their task as adults is to learn how, there's not a fixed profile for their life, because they could be under functioning because the codependency and the dynamic could extend into adulthood, where you have the overfunctioner continuing to overfunctioning and the other siblings are socialized by the codependent person and also stepping into it because they like the warmth of the codependent's care, that the younger siblings or the other siblings will remain under functioning, right? And they have to work on that, which is a whole other set of issues they have to work on. Now, all this is based on the assumption that the conflict we're talking about is based on this dynamic, which, you know, you could have conflicts about all sorts of things. But I will say, anonymous middle tier patron, if I'm reading between, so I'm just going to read between the lines, and there's not a lot of lines to read between, so I'm really taking a leap here. But one, I'm going to assume that you are the codependent, because, or that you're the parentified kid, because typically that would be the person that would identify that and also ask this question, you know, because if you are the parentified person, then you're potentially over preoccupied with your relationship with your siblings to begin with and worried about things. And then, this is just me making shit up. So, but I think it might be relevant. And then, you know, you ask, do you have any general guidance for the healing process in the context of a sibling relationship where there has been parentification? I notice that there's a particular pain that comes from the conflict of this type of relationship because you have one party that has to sacrifice all of their needs for the other. So I'm guessing, again, that you're the parentified overfunctioner, because I don't think you would word it that way. You're saying, I think what you're saying is, hey, I had to sacrifice everything for my sibling. And when we're in conflict or they don't appreciate that or something, it's particularly painful to me. And I don't know the circumstances. And if I knew it, you know, there's a billion other possibilities, but there's a possibility that's what's happening in terms of the systemic dynamic between you and your sibling. So let's say your sibling is younger and you're the parentified one, that as you try to get closer, you, as the parentified person, enact your parentification and your codependency and your overfunctioning, which requires the other person to remain underfunctioning, which might involve control, enabling, putting the other person down. You know, like if, say, you're at Thanksgiving and you're both adults, you're 25, 30 years old, and your younger sister is starting to put mashed potatoes on her plate, and you look over at her and you say something like, oh, you might want to put the potatoes over here because then that'll help with this thing that I know you like. So on one hand, you're being nice, right? You're helping. On the other hand, it's fucking insulting to have your sister dictating what you're supposed to do with your mashed potatoes. Two, it's concerning that you're even paying attention to that shit. You know, like if you're sitting there just putting mashed potatoes on your plate and your sister is breathing down your neck about how you're putting mashed potatoes on your plate, then that's aggravating, right? So there's a possibility that, you know, the possibilities are endless, that the dynamic and even maybe even the way you're trying to work out conflict, you know, what I'm saying is that parentified people have a really hard time understanding that they're parentified, and a really hard, even if they kind of get it, it's based on a lifetime since they were very, very young of socialized understandings that, and they have an excuse for everything. You know, when I'm talking to an overfunctioner and I'm like, hey, you know, I'm pointing out these things. I understand why we got here. I understand why you're like this. It's not your fault. But if you are asking me to help you change this relationship, a big thing you have to learn how to do is manage your anxiety about your loved one failing or even making a grave mistake, maybe even dying because you didn't fix a problem before they took an action. But that's your sibling. You're not responsible for them. You know, you have to be able to sit with that anxiety that your sibling who you were tasked with taking care of, you have to be able to deal with the anxiety in a differentiated way. It's not, we're not going to take the anxiety away, but you can't just go with the anxiety where you've been programmed to go. You have to be able to say, my younger sister might make a choice that will result in bad things happening to my sister and other people. I might even have to sit with watching my younger sister make a number of mistakes where she has a number of negative consequences. When I have that, and it's a lot of conversation, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of validation, a lot of emotions. For that codependent person, for that overfunctioner to be able to even fully believe what I'm saying to them, you know, because what they'll say is, at first, you know, they'll say like, oh, okay, I get it, you know, because this is after maybe years of getting to this point. But when it comes, you know, when push comes to shove and they're in the moment, they're just like, well, Kirk doesn't understand. He doesn't understand. Oh, you know, there's all sorts of excuses. You might, you know, the person might say, Kirk doesn't understand how incompetent my younger sister is or what's at stake here. Or Kirk must come from a family that's very distant, you know, those kinds of thoughts. Or, and I'm not saying me, I'm just saying like anyone's therapist that is putting effort into this, right? Another thing that happens is, like I said, the underfunctioner will sometimes suck the overfunctioner in, right? By sabotaging themselves subconsciously so that the overfunctioner will step in, right? So it's really, really hard to change. And unless there's a lot of therapy and work, it's really hard for two siblings, if they're having conflict around these issues, it's really hard for them to navigate what's happening because there's so, you know, when I did the deep dive on codependency, I called it a personality disorder because I came to the realization during that deep dive that it fits all the criteria for personality disorder because it is based on schemas and early traumas and it completely distorts reality and causes a lot of problems. And there's a, you know, moderate to severe codependent personality disorder, as I'm calling it, involves a disconnection from the self, just like all the other personality disorders. So to change borderline or histrionic or paranoid or avoidant or OCPD, we all understand that that's hard. It takes a long time. And that's the same with codependency. So might as well say about that. All right. Well, let's adjourn there. That was fun to go over emails. I want to do this more because there's a lot of emails and I have a goal to wipe the slate clean. You know, at the beginning of every year, I try to answer all the emails that I can and start anew with the Google Docs that Stacy populates with all of your emails. So hopefully I can get to that at some point. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.